Hello, dreamers, green lighters, and artists of all sorts who march to the beat of your own drum. I am Brooke Warner, and I am accompanied today with my big dreaming co-host, Grant Faulkner. Grant, I'm pretty stoked today, actually, because we're talking to someone who plays a big role in my own green lighting story. Our guest is S. Bear Bergman, and he's one of the people whose story I tell a little bit of in my TEDx talk, because it was Bear's book called Blood, Marriage, Wine, and Glitter that I turned down at Seal Press because I had gotten this message handed to me from the corporate chain of command that we had done too many trans books. And interestingly, we're going to talk about this with Bear today. Within a month of feeling pressured not to acquire his book, this other book came along that I was far less excited about. It was about makeup and how women can look better over 50. And, you know, by contrast to Bear's book, The Powers That Be, were super excited about that book. That was like the story that I tell in my TEDx talk because I was so frustrated. And it was really the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back for me in traditional publishing and ultimately the catalyst for me leaving in 2012. And so Bear is part of that narrative because the experience was such an important and clear moment of truth for me. And what Bear himself later told me he thought was a peak effort moment. And that led to me starting She Writes Press. And so that's the good thing. You know, I've never really looked back.
Wow, Brooke, that's super interesting. I can't wait to hear more. In fact, it sounds like a memoir worthy moment unto itself for you. And I'm excited that we'll get to touch upon that a bit with Bear's Day. I think it's so interesting how, you know, while you were telling that story, I was thinking how we often don't necessarily recognize these big pivotal turning point moments in our lives while they're happening. And it was making me think about this lunch I had with NaNoWriMo founder Chris Beatty way back in 2011. And that was the moment he invited me to the NaNoWriMo board and then also mentioned that he was stepping down and that maybe I should apply for his job. And then at that same lunch, coincidentally, I also told him how I was thinking about launching my little lit journal, 100 Word Story. And he provided just like some crucial encouragement that just kind of tipped me over the fence to deciding to do that. And that began my involvement with the whole flash fiction world as a writer and other things as well. And it was just an ordinary day, an ordinary lunch, yet I wouldn't be here with you now otherwise. So I'm curious to hear more about this catalyst for you that spawned the next big thing that you've now been at for the past 8 years and going strong. I know you talk about dreaming in your TEDx talk, specifically how sometimes you have to let go of one dream to make room for a new dream. And I wonder if you would have qualified leaving Seal Press for She Writes Press as that, as letting go of one dream to make room for a new one.
Yeah, for sure. In retrospect, right? As you're saying, because Seal was my dream job. And for many years, it was everything to me. I mean, I was immersed in it. I was defined by it. I was so proud of the work that we were publishing. And I was working with all these fascinating authors, people like Jessica Valenti and Susie Bright, Amy Ferris, and Kate Bornstein, among others. And so, you know, it just that idea of having something be so much part of your identity and then it being slowly eroded over time. And in my case, it was due to this mandate by this larger corporate publisher who had bought us during the time I was there. And then I saw this thing that I loved being shaped or really prodded actually into something that I didn't want it to be or that I didn't think it was, right? And so as the mandate of the press started to shift, I really wasn't on board. And then little by little, I started seeing that this dream I was living wasn't going to last. And then I had a choice ahead of me, which was to stay and to continue to take those blows and endure those changes that I didn't support, or to strike out on my own and pursue this other dream, you know, even though, of course, at the time I had no idea what She Writes Press would become. And so I feel lucky because it's been a wonderful journey. And I'm really grateful to be looking back in retrospect and to be able to say that I made the right decision. I don't know that that's always the case. And I'm wondering, Grant, if there are parallels here for you around that fateful moment when Chris suggested you apply for your current job.
Yeah, I'll go back even one step before that lunch with Chris Beatty to a moment years earlier that led up to it. One big pivotal moment for me was this moment when I took a misstep in my career when I moved back to the Bay Area in the late 90s, and I found that it wasn't the somewhat affordable artistic haven I'd left a few years earlier. You know, rents had skyrocketed because the internet had happened. So when I returned, I had to find work that allowed me to afford to live here. So I left the world of being a reporter and a teacher to work in corporate communications. And I don't want to disparage that job too much because it was a perfectly good job and I learned a lot, but it just so wasn't me. And that was what pushed me out of it. I knew it was a path that wouldn't intersect with writing or helping others to write. So it was really an inner discomfort, like a true pain or conflict that had been welling up for 7 years in that job that literally, I really do think it literally pushed me out of the job. And I quit and I pledged to myself that I'd never work a job that didn't align with my personal mission in the world. So I started my own freelance writing business, which I found really exhilarating. And it made me realize how I had hidden entrepreneurial skills. And I was very excited to keep doing that. But the tough thing was that I had a toddler at this point and my wife, Heather, was pregnant. So when I stumbled into a job opportunity with a writing nonprofit, the National Writing Project, I took it. And that's really what ushered me into the world where I am now, though. I had to accept the risk of job insecurity and earning less in order to take this path. But I never think I made the wrong decision. I think like you, I reached a moment when I wasn't living according to my deeper values, and I had to find a way to do that. And I find it impossible to have regrets when you take that course.
Yeah, that's inspiring. And so many of us, I mean, most of us maybe have stories like these. And so it's true what you said, like when you're living at the precipice of that big change, you can't really know what's ahead of you. But I love what you said. It's like you're being pushed to make a change. And of course, at the same time, it's super scary because the status quo is a known quantity, of course. But I was talking to a friend the other day who's really unhappy in her marriage, and it struck me that she's at a similar precipice, only it's personal versus professional, but all the emotions are the same. You know, she's not happy, but there's part of her that doesn't want to leave because of what she knows, and there's comfort in that life and the house and the partner and the adult children who come home and visit. And on the other side is this abyss and this unknown. And while you can think about the possibility and, you know, what's better out there, it's still going to be accompanied by fear. And it's just striking me, you know, you really don't know until you look in the rearview mirror and walk the walk and then be able to say later, like, yeah, I'm so glad I made that choice.
Yeah, you know, we're confronted with these choice moments in our lives, and it takes so much courage to look at a situation like that. You know, whether it's your unhappiness and your job or your friend's unhappiness in her marriage, and then make an intentional change. I also think it's complicated because we admire people who have the strength and courage to strike out and change their lives, but it does often take being pushed to a pretty negative place to feel like you can make that change. I know that was the case for Bear, that he was just confronting the publishing industry over and over again, telling him there was no readership for his books until he finally got pushed into a corner and was like, you know what, I'm doing this on my own. And then he founded his own micropress, Flamingo Rampant. And I feel like this is a kind of a familiar story in the publishing industry, actually, right, Brooke?
Yeah, it is. And maybe in the creative arts in general, actually. It's funny because we're kind of talking about rejection, right? It's a particular mm-hmm. type of rejection, because in the industry, you have a gatekeeper who's the agent or the editor. That person holds the power to make the determinations about what kind of content people will read. But if you're a writer and you're out there and you know there's a readership for your book because you know your community, like in Bear's case, or because you've gotten really incredible feedback about your story or your writing, then there can be this real disconnect when someone says to you, yeah, we don't think it's going to sell, right? So honestly, these writers who have the gumption to say back or to themselves, you know what, they're not right. I do know that I have a readership. Those writers really are the backbone of the indie publishing movement. And just having this conversation right now connects me right back to my TEDx talk, because I was just, was then and still am, truly inspired by these folks who I call greenlighters, because it does take a lot, you know, to get those kinds of rejections, oftentimes many rejections, and then say to yourself, my book is worthwhile. My book has a readership. I'm going to do this anyway. And then those greenlighters, you know, especially over these last 10 years or so, have really elevated themselves to such a degree that the traditional industry, in my opinion, has lost a lot of clout and respect because they're doing this thing of measuring worthiness, with the author's celebrity, or, you know, caring much more about an author's following than they do the books themselves. And so while that's something that I rail against from time to time, I'm also grateful for it because it's exactly how we got to this place of having such a thriving indie publishing scene with micro presses like Flamingo Rampant and bigger non-traditional presses like She Writes Press occupying this really meaningful place in the larger publishing ecosystem.
Definitely really meaningful. As one who has published with smaller presses and as one who writes things that don't really fit into the conventions that the bigger publishers are looking for, I'm infinitely thankful for small presses and indie publishing. And it's important, you know, more so now than ever since we're down to the big four publishers with this recent acquisition news of Penguin Random House buying Simon & Schuster. You know, it was just yesterday, it seems that we had the big six. So they're really consolidating, falling like dominoes.
Yeah, they sure are. So if anybody tries to tell you that publishing is not a fascinating industry, do not believe it. The pace of change in this industry is really something to behold. And it does impact all of us because the publishing industry literally directs what we consume, what we know, what we share. And so I'm always going to be both really moved and grateful to dreamers like Bear and his whole line of books that are intentionally and beautifully feminist and racially diverse and LGBTQ positive books for kids. Super important work that he's doing. So I can't wait to hear directly from him about his story and this story of just following the next right step.
Yeah, me too, Brooke, and everyone. Hang tight with us because we'll be right back after this shortest of breaks.
Hello, everybody. We are back, and today's guest is S. Bear Bergman, who is an author, storyteller, educator, and the founder and publisher of children's book publisher Flamingo Rampant, which makes feminist, culturally diverse picture books celebrating LGBTQ+ kids and families. He writes creative nonfiction for grownups, fiction for children, resolutely factual features for various publications, and the advice column, Asking Bear. He was also the co-editor, along with Kate Bornstein, of Gender Outlaws, The Next Generation. And these days, he spends most of his time making transcultural competency interventions any way he can and trying to avoid stepping on Lego. I love that bio, Bear. Hello. We're so happy to have you on the show with us. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's so good. This is kind of a full circle moment for me, because earlier in the episode, I was sharing with our listeners how much you're a part of my story of leaving traditional publishing, which is a story that I told in my TEDx talk. And I know you remember the story, so I'm not going to repeat that here. But I remember when I was catching up with you when I was preparing for my TEDx talk, and you introduced me to this term, the peak effort moment, which I immediately loved, and I used it in my talk. And so I wonder if we could open today with you talking about your own publishing peak effort moment as it pertains to starting Flamingo Rampant.
Absolutely. We and my husband and I and our kids, when we started Flamingo Rampant, part of what happened is that I'd been invited by the folks at one of the big conferences for gender independent and trans kids and their families to write some stories to read to the kids at the conference. They sort of have camp during the day while their parents are taking workshops. So I wrote a couple of stories, in part because the ones that existed at that time in 2009, about, they all relied heavily on narratives of bullying, harassment, ostracization when talking about LGBTQ topics. It was very, some kid or some family is queer or trans, and for a large portion of the book, people are horrible about it, and at the end, it becomes magically okay. And that was frustrating. It's very hard to read that kind of a book to a kid before bed and then say, okay, sweet dreams, you know, and especially when there are, when all of the available books have that narrative, there's no way to read children books that represent or reflect their experience in family, in community, without also normalizing the idea of people being horrible about it. So I tried very hard to publish those original stories through traditional publishing, and no one wanted them. I got positive feedback on my writing, but every editor said some version of, this is too niche for us. One editor said, these are very cute, I can't take it, but if you read any stories about normal children, I'd love to take a look. Which I will never forget as long as I live. So we ran a Kickstarter and we published the first two books, and I thought, okay, we've done the thing. You know, people will surely be able to see now that there's really a market and that this is important. But that didn't happen. And instead, the big five or the big four or whatever it is now just kept publishing these same books that editors, and they were all cisgender, heterosexual editors, said were realistic. And they followed these sort of same grim storylines. And occasionally there would be the addition of a storyline that was pretty much a version of, some people have two dads, and that's not terrible. The end. which, you know, okay, but like also not really what I needed out of the books that I wanted to be reading to my children and to the other kids that we knew. And then a book came out that I won't name, but it was much vaunted as being a new and exciting moment in books about gender-independent kids. And it arrived, and I read it finally after a lot of anticipation. And it was the same business. The first half of the book, this kid is not well treated because they wanted to do something gender non-compliant. And that's when I reached my moment. I remember very clearly the book arrived. My husband was out. I think he was teaching that evening. I read the book to my then four-year-old child. And when we were done and I tucked them in and said, you know, good night, sweet dreams, I went immediately to the kitchen table and got out, you know, a big yellow legal pad. And I just was all done. That was the moment at which I had reached peak effort. And again, all of the same problems in children's literature were also true about this book. All of the characters were white. All of them were able-bodied. Married heterosexual parents. The child lives in the suburbs. They have their own bedroom. All of the people are sort of straight-sized people, right? No one is fat in the book. And I just felt like we can't continue in this way making these reflections for children that don't reflect them lovingly, that don't reflect them positively, that show yet another episode in this sort of very special episode series where kids' identities or their behavior or their family are the problem that need to be solved. And I really just wanted kids to be able to see themselves doing the same things that kids do in all kinds of other children's books. They have adventures. They solve problems. They make mistakes. They rely on each other. They, you know, in Flamingo Rampant books, they go to space and hunt for pirates and, you know, meet dragons. Fun, exciting things that kids are actually interested in. But I just felt like we can't continue making these same books for these kids who really need to see themselves reflected lovingly.
Bear, that's the perfect segue for my question for you is, that was also so inspiring, and I'm so glad you're doing this good work. You know, I think that kids, when I look at my kids and the kids they're around, they're just so much more open than most of the adults I know about stuff like gender fluidity and two moms and dad families. And, you know, I admittedly live somewhat in the bubble here in Berkeley. So most of the kids my kids are friends with are somewhere on the gender fluid scale. And so it's just a really different world than when we were growing up. So I'm curious if when you talk to kids and young people, if you feel that they still, you know, need this education, or is it really the adults whose minds you are hoping to expand through the mission of your work?
Well, what I'll say is that we are primarily focused always on the kids. I definitely receive a lot of feedback from adults who have many feelings about our work that are not positive. We also certainly receive positive feedback. But I definitely am aware that the adults are consistently having a harder time with it than the kids. As a parent, and as I'm sure you know, I'm also super aware that kids, you know, their values about the world are heavily influenced by their parents' values. And so one of the things for me that's very important about Flamingo Rampant is an opportunity for any kid to be able to understand that any kid can be the hero of a story. There's an amazing educator, a Black literacy educator named Dr. Rudine Sims Bishop. And she talks about how a book in the hands of a child is either a mirror or a window. Right? Relatively self-explanatory. In the book, they either see their experience reflected or they see a window into someone else's life. And I think that traditional publishing, whenever they make LGBTQ themed books, they're always thinking about the value of that book as a window. They're primarily concerned with the experience of white kids from heterosexual families who are able-bodied, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And at Flamingo Rampant, we're always thinking first about the value of the book as a mirror, about the kid who is seeing themselves for the first time and feeling loved that way, feeling uplifted that way. And I think it makes better and more interesting books for the kids who do experience those books as a window. And, you know, we know that kids read books at school, they take out books through the library. So wherever a kid happens to meet one of our Flamingo Rampant books, and however their parents may feel about LGBTQ kids or families, what I really want is for them to take a little bit of our values with them as well. And maybe it really underlines and reflects what they're learning at home, or maybe it serves as a bit of a counterpoint to what they may have heard at home or at school on the playground or whatever. But I think that kids also need the support that our kind of stories provide, either to give them another way to possibly think about things or to reinforce for them that their family's positive experiences of LGBTQ people are valid and valuable.
Right. So important, Bear. And, you know, I know you're a storyteller and an educator and ultimately just a man of super many talents. And I was wondering if you could talk about your own introduction to books when you were young and what your own experience was like back then. I'm just wondering, like, whenever it was that you had an awareness about your own gender identity, were there any books that validated those early experiences for you?
There really were not any books that validated my experience particularly. I definitely had a lot of books. My grandmother, who is now dead, but who was a kindergarten and first grade teacher, was the one who taught me how to read when I was three. And I immediately was super enthusiastic about books and reading. But when I was a kid, there weren't really books that showed my experience as a very, you know, curious, nerdy child. Never mind books that showed my experience as a Jewish kid. There weren't any books that showed my experience as a kid who was pretty gender non-compliant, even at that time. I remember a book called Caddy Woodlawn was sort of my first introduction to a kid who was kind of like me. Harriet the Spy also filled that moment for me a little bit. You know, they were, I'm trans, so at the time the world really experienced me as a young girl, which I don't know how I would have felt about that if I'd understood that it was possible to be anything else. But of course, at that time, there really wasn't any conversation in my family or most North American families about trans or non-binary people. You know, colonization and the process of destroying indigenous cultures really robbed a lot of us of that, because of how resolutely the colonizers erased all evidence of people that today we would understand as lesbian, gay, bi, trans, queer, non-binary. But none of the books that I had showed a kid like me in any meaningful way. And it's distressing that, you know, it's now 30, 35, 40 years later, and there are still a lot of children who never have an opportunity to really see themselves, to see their cultural celebrations, to see their embodied experience, their gender experience, even their family experience. You know, we, in the last season, we made a book about two adults who are divorced and co-parent two children, and everybody loves each other and they live close by, but the kids go back and forth. And even that part of the story was surprising to people who'd only ever experienced divorce in children's books. Again, as sort of a very special episode kind of thing, you know, Dinosaurs Get Divorced Too is the actual title of a children's book where kids can learn about divorced families, but it's never normalized. It's never written in a way where a kid can look at it and think, oh yeah, that's a thing that is also part of my experience, but also other things get to happen.
Well, in closing, Barry, you've written so many different kinds of books and you're a Lambda Literary Award finalist and really a recognized name in the LGBTQ writing circles. I am curious about your thoughts about the categorization and by extension marginalization that is imposed on LGBTQ folks by the industry, and what, if anything, queer writers can do about it, and what, if anything, readers can do about it.
Oh, it's a difficult question. I feel like publishing is organized. Traditional publishing is organized to categorize LGBTQ work as a sort of niche publication, but that's not for me where my real frustration lies. For me, it's about the fact that heterosexual cisgender writers writing about trans and queer topics get much more publisher support, bigger advances, more attention than when queer and trans writers write about ourselves. You know, I can think of a particular book that came out right at about the same time as my most recent book for grown people. I can't say adult books, that's a different thing. But, you know, because I write both for children and for grownups, right? And I had written a book about family, a collection of essays called Blood, Marriage, Wine, and Glitter, which is about all of the different ways that queer and trans people make family. And, you know, it got lovely reviews. People were very enthusiastic about it. But at the same time, a woman published a book about her experience with a gay dad, and she's roughly my age. And that book was published by a traditional publisher that had never even been willing to look at my own books. And she received an advance that was 40 times what I received. And, you know, her book came out with, you know, deckled edges and French flaps and all sorts of other fancy touches that publishers use when they want you to understand that a book is serious and interesting. And I hear versions of this story from every LGBTQ writer that I know. Publishers will say, like, oh, we already have a gay book this season, or we already have a trans project that we're working on. But those rules somehow don't apply to people external to the community who are writing about, you know, their relative or their person that they encountered in their work. And so if we're going to be able to do anything about how queer and trans work gets siloed, I think it's going to have to start with traditional publishing embracing the own voices movement and valuing the books that a lot of us who are marginalized in various ways write about our own experiences as not only just as valid as, but in fact, more valid than books that are written about us from an outside perspective. As writers writing from within queer and trans communities, it's not clear that there's a lot we can do to bust out of that silo. I think that editors and publishers need to give a lot more attention to how they acquire and how they market the books that represent our lives and prioritize the ones written by us, not just about us.
Thank you, Bear. Goodness, we're so aligned on this topic, and so I love hearing from you about it, and I'm excited for our listeners to kind of take that in, and super grateful for the work that you're doing at Flamingo Rampant, so keep it up.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me on. What great questions.
All right, everyone. We are going to hear about a fantastic book from Brooke right after this break.
Today's book pick is a Flamingo Rampant book because I want to introduce all of you to Bear's Press, Flamingo Rampant. And so the book that I'm picking is called Is That for a Boy or a Girl? And this is a story about some awesome kids who get super fed up with being told that certain things are for girls and other things are only for boys. And so the story is about how they mix things up and then they get to choose what's best for them based on what they actually like and not what they're supposed to like just because of their gender. And so, like many of Flamingo Rampant's book, this is a celebration of non-conformity and non-binary interests. And I wanted to just mention, I have, I think, about 10 Flamingo Rampant books that I have read with my son over the years. They fund all of their work through Kickstarter, and so I'm a supporter of all of Bear's Kickstarter campaigns, and I just wanted to encourage everybody to check out their site and support the work that they're doing. The books are refreshingly fun and upbeat, and they don't other LGBTQ experiences, which is really one of the main reasons I love them. So check them out, flamingorampant.com, and if you can, you can fund a future Kickstarter campaign.
Thanks, Brooke. Yes, check out Flamingo Rampant and continue to check us out. We're a weekly podcast and you can download us on your favorite platform, I'm sure. If you can leave us a little review, that would be great. We love those reviews. We love reading them. They give us power. They give us fuel. And that's what we need to keep doing this every week. So thanks so much.